I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. David Morris was a lieutenant in the Marine Corps back in the 1990s and saw no combat. Later, he worked as an embedded journalist covering the Iraq War, where he saw death, suffering, and carnage up close. In the fall of 2007, he was nearly killed when the Humvee he was riding in hit an IED. Morris began having nightmares and flashbacks and a feeling of alienation when he came back to the States. His new book, The Evil Hours, is a scientific and historical exploration of post-traumatic stress disorder that's been known by different names through the years. It's also about his own personal journey to understand what being so close to death had done to him. He writes that combat troops are not the only people who experience traumatic symptoms. So do sexual assault victims and survivors of natural disasters. Morris's descriptions of PTSD are vivid and frightening and poetic and insightful. For instance, he calls the condition a disease of time. David Morris joins us in our Philadelphia studio, and congratulations on your book, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times. I know you had to raise some money on Kickstarter to finish this book, and you wrote, "I first got interested in PTSD when I read a newspaper article about how some Iraq War veterans felt poisoned." That was their word, poisoned by the war. What was it about that word or what they were saying that struck you?
I guess what I noticed when I first returned from Iraq the first time in 2004, I just felt slightly out of time and out of place. I had only been to the Middle East for about 3 months, but it felt like 10 years had passed. And in that way, apart from even the poisoning feeling, there is this sense you get when you talk to veterans and other trauma survivors that, for instance, going to a war is almost like a form of time travel. And you do come back and things are different. The clothes seem different. The people seem different. The language seems to have changed. And there's stories that you've missed out on that you're not aware of. So you have this sort of Rip Van Winkle feeling. And that was kind of how, over time, I noticed that the war had put me out of time, in a sense, from everyone else. And that feeling of apartness and separation is something that I think a lot of veterans and a lot of trauma survivors feel, that they've lived in this underworld, this alternate form of consciousness for a period of time. And as they're coming out and trying to reintegrate themselves into the world, that is when you begin to notice that you are different and the world is different. And there's this process of reintegration that needs to occur. And the book, among other things, is a description and sort of a meditation and visitation on that idea of how that change process happens.
In fact, in many ways, and not to boil PTSD down to one thing, but there is a kind of basic question that you say is integral to understanding PTSD, which is, how do you live after you've almost died? I mean, in certain ways, you have lived that because you were in this near-death experience in a way. But that's a question we need to grapple with in order to understand PTSD.
Yeah, and that's sort of one of the many vexing philosophical questions at the heart of PTSD is, how does human consciousness change? How does memory change? How do people's sense of themselves change after they've been very, very close to the end of consciousness, the end of the possible end of life? And it's important to recognize that, you know, it's easy to see how that works out in a veteran's experience, you know, almost being killed by an IED blast, these sorts of things. But researchers in the 1970s who first began putting the ideas together for PTSD began speaking to rape survivors and discovered, and prior to the 1970s, rape had sort of been thought of as a really unfortunate set of circumstances, but not really a capital crime. And researchers in Boston who interviewed rape survivors found that almost all of them felt and were convinced that they would die, that they would either be killed or it was the death of part of themselves, the incidents of being raped. So that sort of the idea that PTSD could come, mm-hmm. that there needed to be some sort of recognition of that particular experience was a big part of the story of PTSD and why it's such a big part of our culture. As we recognize, you know, you could say that, you know, 5 to 6% of all American women have suffered from PTSD because of the problem we have with rape in our country.
Let me take you back, if I can, to this is October 2007, and you're embedded in Iraq. You're in Baghdad in a Humvee going through the streets with some soldiers there, and the Humvee hits an IED. Describe, if you can, that moment. I mean, there is a real before and after.
Yeah, I was on a patrol with the 1st Infantry Division, and we were asked by the headquarters to go look at, to go check out this street, which was on fire. And there were the Shia burning out their Sunni neighbors, and sort of this slow motion ethnic cleansing happening there. So we drove down this street, and as the patrol entered, we discovered that we'd actually driven into a dead end. So the patrol decided they had to turn around, do a 3-point turn, and get out of there. And so one of the last things I remember clearly is the armored personnel carrier, the Bradley at the front of the column, beginning to pivot and turn around, and the tracks grinding on the asphalt really heavily, and you could feel that through the floor of the Humvee I was riding in. So as we began to back up, we hit an IED buried in the trash, and then time got a little bit fuzzy. It was a little bit weird for me, and then eventually, and the Humvee caught on fire, and everyone in the Humvee, no one was physically injured, although everyone inside the vehicle, and the gunner who was half out of the, sticking halfway out of the vehicle, lost their hearing. But eventually we made it back to the patrol base, and then a half hour later I was in a clinic getting my head examined, and then a week later I was back in California, back in the United States.
I mean, was that a real one of those sort of before and after experiences? So at that moment, you, not to be overly dramatic here, but in a sense you became a different person?
Well, yes and no. That was certainly the most melodramatic confrontation I had with the war, in a sense. But, I lived in Iraq off and on for, from 2004 to 2007, about 10 months in country total. And, there was one unit I was with that was mortared every day for 7 days. So there was every day you would see. And, I went to Fallujah and Ramadi and some of the worst places in the war. And that's an important thing to recognize, is that for veterans and the way the wars are fought now, like an Afghanistan veteran, in many cases, there's not always one single cardinal life-changing event. There often is, but just as powerful are the daily stresses and the daily exposure to privation, the hot and cold and the lack of privacy, and then just living in the shadow of death for your entire 7-month or 15-month deployment. So it often is one single event and then a culmination of what some clinicians call small T traumas.
One of the soldiers in the Humvee started screaming at you, basically saying, "Look, I have to be here. I mean, I signed up for this. You're a reporter. You don't have to be here." He was furious at you. Maybe this was a lark.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of an interesting, it was very strange conversation to have at the end of this ambush, but. This soldier named Reaper in the book, he very smart guy, was beginning to read, had read Catch 22, and we were talking about Camus in theater when we were in Iraq and Slaughterhouse 5, the great novel by Kurt Vonnegut, and he'd been asking me questions about it, and so but prior to the ambush, we'd been kind of having this sort of like this dorm philosophy conversation, and. So we had this kind of connection, and then after the ambush happened, and everybody, we came out of the ambush area, and we were, going to be safe soon, and everybody began thinking about, sort of reflecting. And, this soldier got really mad at me because he was thinking, like, why in the hell are you here? I have to be here. And over time, that question kind of echoed in my head for a long time, because I had been a Marine infantry officer. I'd spent most of my early adulthood studying and training for war, and could not, and all of my friends were serving in Iraq. My old unit was there. I was living in San Diego at the time, so units were constantly leaving and going. It was this big revolving door. So I didn't feel like I had a choice in a way, and as a writer, I felt like it was my obligation, in a sense, that was my form of service. And so, but as I've gone back and as I've gotten older and I've decided to not do war correspondence anymore, I still have friends that go to Afghanistan, that want to go to Syria. But for me, I came to the conclusion that I needed to sort of move on. And his question about why am I here is one that I try to answer in other parts of the book, is like, why? And I think it's a good question for all soldiers and friends of soldiers and veterans to ask. It's like, why? What is the nature of service? Why do you serve? What is it about America and the wars that makes you feel like that we need to be there, you need to be there, and just sort of think about how that fits into the larger tapestry of your life.
Well, you're pretty honest about it. You said, and this is when you signed up to be in the Marine Corps, I wanted adventure, I wanted stories, I wanted to make other people envious. That pretty much – did that also describe maybe why you also wanted to be an embedded reporter?
Yeah, it was – you know, I'm a mountaineer. I surf. And my dad's a Vietnam veteran. I come from a very sort of mountain man family, for lack of a better phrase. And so the idea of adventure and the insights that you would gain – that you gain from putting your life at risk in sort of the Hemingway fashion was something that I – although I wasn't really like a lit nerd kid, it was something that definitely spoke to me. You know, I went into the Marine Corps because I thought it was the hardest service, the most arduous training, and had the greatest likelihood of adventure and jumping out of helicopters and climbing mountains and those sorts of things. So, I've always been drawn as a person, and subsequently as a writer, to extreme experiences, and that was one of the reasons I went to the war, and I kept returning, is that I felt that war was an extreme version of human life. Life pushed to its edge, and I felt like the longer I could stay there and the closer I could get to death, the more I would understand something about the nature of existence, something about the nature of humanity. So I kept going back and interviewing people like this soldier Reaper who had been in the war longer than I had, and the war had really, you know, instead of a happy childhood, he'd had Iraq. Instead of having, you know, an adolescence, he'd had Iraq, and that was like how he came to term as a man, as a person. And so I was interested, and that was an interesting, you know, war is so many things, and one of the things it is for a lot of people is a sentimental education.
Sentimental education.
Yeah, and it, you know, in terms of, you know, a coming of age kind of thing, and what the lessons that we choose to take from it are what determine that those determine the nature of our country. And so one of the things that's interesting about post-traumatic stress disorder is it came out of the legacy of Vietnam. And it was, it's a moral argument or a moral lesson to say, you know, war is a political thing that we do. It's a political enterprise we do to, you know, modify the globe and use it. And we have to fight when our country is threatened. But there are also things that there are lingering long-term psychological impacts of war that have to be dealt with. And the idea of considering those survivors of war and rape as having experience that needs to be internalized by the culture and needs to be considered in the larger context of spirituality and wisdom, that's one of the most important things about PTSD. It does impact people and give you symptoms and something that needs to be treated in a medical sense, but mm-hmm. It has a huge, an equal part, an equally large part of PTSD is the moral part of it, of that veterans have seen our country, our culture pushed to its extreme. We need to listen to them. And the same holds true for rape survivors and survivors of natural disaster that also have PTSD. They have seen our society pushed to its extreme, and we need to incorporate and listen to and incorporate their lessons into our daily lives in order for our society to be better.
I do want to pick up on that quick short break here on Radio Times. That's David Morris, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. We are going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with David Morris, who suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder after being embedded as a journalist in Iraq. Returning home, he began to explore PTSD, its medical and cultural history. He spoke with researchers and survivors, and not only combat veterans, but people who have been victims of rape or domestic abuse and natural disasters. His book is called The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. And again, to join our conversation, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. You can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. You describe your Humvee being hit in 2007. You come back to the States, and it seems like there's almost like a honeymoon that you have, because it really isn't until 2 years later, till 2009, that you begin to experience some of these overt symptoms of PTSD. Why do you think that lag time?
That's a good question. I think most of the research in my life sort of bears this out, is there is sort of this honeymoon period when you return from the war. And I think it's generally about 30 days, maybe one lunar cycle. You come back and you're not, you know, your family is sort of a little bit hesitant, and your social circle can be a little bit hesitant at first. But then as everyone settles back into the normal rhythm of life, and you notice that your place in that normal rhythm is not what it used to be, then you begin to – that readjustment process has to begin or fails to begin in some cases. But for me, and I noticed that I felt different, and particularly, to bring it back to some of the larger political issues, I came back in 2004, watched the first Battle of Fallujah, and Abu Ghraib happened when I was in Iraq. And then I returned in July 2004, and then President Bush was reelected in November, which was very upsetting and disillusioning for me because of what I had seen. So I began to very – and I had voted for President Bush the first time, and so that was a very upsetting and alienating and disorienting process to observe, considering my experiences in Iraq. But subsequent to that, with respect to more specifically psychiatric or medical experiences that I had, it wasn't until 2009, and I don't really have a good answer for why there was that gap. But what happened in 2009 was I was in a movie theater watching an action movie, and I don't want to say which movie it was. It wasn't a war. It was not a war movie. It was a Marvel Comics superhero movie. And in the movie, there was an explosion, an IED depicted in the movie, and it was shot in the Humvee from the same point of view that I would have held, which is the back of the Humvee, maybe the back right. And so the scene in the movie, and it was so realistically rendered, and it was so loud in the theater, that it really became, for me, it was just overwhelming because it was so close to what I imagined my death might look like. And so in the movie theater, this vision overwhelmed me and overwhelmed my mind, which kind of shut down like an overloaded electrical grid. And I basically kind of blacked out. And, when I regained full consciousness, it was in the hallway of the Cineplex I was in. And I had my body.
So you lost
was,
time in a sense between that moment and there you were in the hallway.
Yeah.
Talking about time.
Yeah. And I had to run, I ran out of the theater. And eventually I calmed myself down a little bit and then slipped back into the theater and sat down next to my girlfriend at the time that I was seeing the movie with. And I'm like, well, what happened? She's like, well, there was an explosion in the movie and you ran out. And so that was kind of the first hint that I had that I was on the other side of something.
I wonder too, and you write about this and I'm sure a lot of other, people who have been to war come back to the United States, especially these two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, just feeling angry because so much of the country is so uninvolved and so unengaged with war. It's happening over there. It doesn't really intrude on our lives.
Yeah, and that's a really tricky thing. And I was actually talking to a veteran yesterday, a New Jersey National Guardsman, and we were talking about things, and anger management is kind of one of the major issues for returning veterans, in part because as a soldier, you're trained to be violent and you're trained to be, to use violence to control, to defeat the enemy. And so it becomes sort of you're being a soldier is a different form of an experience. And so you have to learn how to control your anger and your frustration in a different way. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that it's just, as a soldier and deployed overseas, you do suffer a lot. There's a lot of exposure to the elements and a lack of privacy. And I know, speaking for myself, it's just when you get back to the U.S., it's hard to, life is frustrating, but you have to find a new way to express, your frustrations or your anxiety. And so, anger management is kind of one of the sort of subsets that's not in the official diagnosis for PTSD, but it's certainly a common experience among PTSD survivors.
Did you want to talk about what you had seen when you came back to the States? Did you feel like people would understand what you had seen and experienced?
I did want to talk about it, and I felt like I had seen, in 2004, many of us remember 11 years ago now, there was this, Iraq was the political discussion of the year, in terms of the media and the coverage. But so you come back and you've seen a lot of things, at least you think you have. Right. And a lot of people are not really, Americans don't really, one of the part of coming back from the war was this real disappointment in my country. I was very, I served in the Marine Corps. I was very much a patriotic young American, but I was really disappointed in what I learned about America when I returned. Because America is not a very introspective country, we're not very retrospective, and there didn't seem to be a deep enough interest in what was really at stake in the Middle East and in Iraq, and there wasn't really a willingness to sort of learn about Arab culture or how we were going to win the war. There was this just very polarized political sense of, you tended to get two or three types of comments. Like the number one thing was like people would ask you, well, did you kill anybody over there?
I know.
And then other people would make a lot of people made racist comments about Arabs, saying, you know, and stuff that has appeared in the American Sniper book, which, you know, Chris Kyle was obviously an Iraq veteran. But I stridently reject that way of looking at Arabs as savages. But a lot of Americans do believe that, and which I think is insulting and really ignorant way to, you know, to interpret, you know, the people from, you know, Arabs. So I was, you know, that is a very common response, though, is people have these very sort of closed-minded views about, you know, what the war is really all about. And that was not, you know, that I got to know Iraqis. I knew a lot of Marines that taught themselves Arabic overseas in order to serve, in order to be better warriors, in order to serve their country. And so you come back and you deal with this really noxious political environment where people don't seem to want to learn, and it's very frustrating.
Are you still angry?
Oh, totally. Yeah, it's something I've tried to let go of and not really dwell on, because anger, you know, trauma is caused by thousands of different kinds of things. You know, there are a million ways to be traumatized, but if you indulge and sit and stew in your anger, there's one place that you're going to end up, and that's you alone in a room, probably with a bottle. And so you have to, you know, that was one reason, that was sort of one growth process of writing this book, was accepting that you have to let some of that anger go. I mean, this week in particular, I'm a little bit, I'm a little bit on edge just because American Sniper is the number one movie in America, and we're refighting the Iraq War essentially this month. People, you know, having conversations with people, and everyone wants to tell me about Iraq and how they felt about the movie. And, you know, and I spent a month in Ramadi, and I spent a week in the same neighborhood, same patrol base that's depicted in the movie. So I don't really want to see a movie of it. I was there, you know, which may sound closed-minded and arrogant, but that's how I feel.
Let me reintroduce you. That's David Morris, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And we're talking about his new book. It's called The Evil Hours. It's subtitled A Biography of Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. It's both a historical scientific medical exploration of PTSD, a diagnosis that really only just came out of the Vietnam War. But as David Morris writes, soldiers returning from war and those who have experienced war, even trauma, have often had some of the same symptoms of those experiences. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. I want to make just a little diversion here, because you also write about the Hanoi Hilton. This is during the Vietnam War, where John McCain and others were held there. And you describe it as, you know, a place of horror indeed, and he was tortured, which is horrifying to think about. But nonetheless, these were soldiers who were there, in a sense, or Marines there together as a kind of group experiencing what went on, and perhaps that helped to mitigate some of the trauma of war. Because not everyone who comes back from war is traumatized by it, even if they've seen horrible things.
Right, right. And the Hanoi Hilton, which is a group of prisoners of war that John McCain belonged to, and John McCain, for instance, was incarcerated for 5.5 years. Yeah. And interestingly, that group, which has been studied exhaustively, 569 prisoners that were all held in largely the same area in central Hanoi, has one of the lowest PTSD rates on record, about 4% lifetime PTSD rate, which is a fraction of the 12 to 15 to 17% that we see for today's Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. And so the question is, well, why did they have such a low PTSD rate? And there's a number of identifiable discrete factors that researchers have identified as to why. And a lot of them have to do with the fact that that John McCain and his peers were a little bit older, higher ranking, had been to college, had been through years of training. Some of them had been through mock prisoner of war camps. So there was this sense of preparation and being ready for the really traumatic experience of being held at the Hanoi Hilton. And in addition to that, in a really interesting way, the Hanoi Hilton people, the prisoners, were welcomed back to the United States and treated almost like returning astronauts. And they were feted. They had a party thrown for them at the White House by President Nixon. Frank Sinatra was there. Sammy Davis Jr. was there. And everybody there, all the prisoners that were returned to the U.S. got lifetime tickets to Major League Baseball, you know, so they got all these sort of perks. And we do thank veterans for their service today, which is very important and is shown to be helpful as a welcoming home experience. But interestingly, and that's one reason I spoke about John McCain in this book, is that everyone knows that story.
Yes.
We've heard about it over and over again.
Yes.
And everyone, and the wisdom and the stories that John McCain all those experiences have been told and internalized and converted into a kind of cultural wisdom and a cultural mythology. And so they felt like that experience, their suffering, was actually something, a learning experience for the whole country. And that helps explain, I think, why they have such a low PTSD rate.
Do you think there is a risk, though, of, in a sense, pathologizing PTSD? Because in many ways, when you think about it, it seems like a natural response to trauma, to have nightmares and to be set off by something that you might see in a movie. That seems like such a natural human response.
Yeah, and it is in a certain level. And PTSD it is a recognized mental health condition, but it also is really an exaggerated response to overwhelming stress. And there is, I mean, a distinction has to be drawn between people who suffer some of the symptoms of PTSD and recover fully and go on with their lives, and then people that suffer and continue to have like a chronic struggle with post-traumatic stress disorder. But generally speaking, yeah, it's I think also important to recognize that you know 12 to 15% of Iraq veterans are going to end up with diagnosable PTSD, but an equal number of them, and perhaps a greater number, experience what this sort of new field, which is called post-traumatic growth, where people are actually beginning to talk about the positive experiences of a situation like surviving a war. But yeah, there is some veterans that I interviewed for this book said they're concerned because one of the assumptions is, if you went to Iraq, you must have PTSD. And I think to a degree PTSD is many things to many people, but it's become sort of the shorthand for the war experience as a whole and a stereotype rather than and it sort of stands in place of an actual healthy conversation that we might have about the war. So it's a very useful, powerful concept and really a political, social, and medical concept, but it's important that we don't let the PTSD get in the way of a deeper, more rich, more resonant, wisdom-generating conversation that we can have with trauma survivors. But yeah, it's weird. I get the feeling a lot of times that people just assume that every veteran is going to come back with PTSD, and that's just not the case.
And that's David Morris, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. You have a chapter in here about going for therapy for your PTSD, and one of the treatments that the first treatment that you had was called prolonged exposure therapy. Actually, an idea developed by a psychiatrist here in the Philadelphia area, Edna Fowa. The idea is that you sort of relive some of these traumatic experiences as a way to get over them. Sort of sold to you as this was going to work. It works with like 85% of people who experience this. This is going to work for you. It didn't work for you. But what was the experience like for you?
Prolonged exposure is the VA's number one individual psychotherapy. And the idea behind prolonged exposure is that you tell the story of your worst trauma over and over again until eventually the memory loses its traumatic charge and becomes like any other normal memory. It's proven to work for about 60% of veterans. A very good friend of mine, a veteran of the Battle of Fallujah, it worked wonders for him. However, we do know that it causes significant side effects, and it actually makes symptoms of PTSD worse in about 28% of patients. I was one of those 28%. I was asked to tell the story of my IED ambush, roughly about 80 times in sessions with a therapist, and I found that it made my symptoms much worse. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't read. I couldn't write. I tried to go for a run, and my legs cramped up. And so there is this, and I think this is one of the things that I learned over the course of looking into this issue, is that there are the VA has produced these very effective, mass-produced, one-size-fits-all therapies, which do treat a number of veterans. But the idea of a veteran sitting down and having a one-on-one, genuine, authentic, emotional exchange where insights are achieved is not something the VA is really investing in. And these therapies like prolonged exposure, which have a very good scientific record, are very one-size-fits-all and not individualized. And they're designed to be manualized. And basically, you're going down a checklist. And they've really minimized a lot of the genuine human interaction of it. And so the capacity to feel like your story is being heard and understood has really been minimized. You know, I'm not a fan of prolonged exposure. I think I described it to other therapists, and they said, well, that sounds like not like therapy. It sounds like an exorcism. I think the VA has a lot of questions to answer about it, because if they're offering a therapy to a very vulnerable population, even if they even temporarily exacerbate their symptoms, that is a potentially life-threatening situation that needs to be addressed. So I sort of feel like I was sold a bill of goods with respect to prolonged exposure. You know, I've looked at the research. There's some good research, but there are some problems right. with it that are not being addressed.
Well, let me ask you, because as you describe, we can't run the experiment here, whether it was the therapy or whether it was the therapist, because it sounded right. like the therapist you had either were sort of new to this this form of treatment or even new to therapy itself. And one wonders, I guess, maybe in better, more sophisticated hands, whether it would have worked for you or not.
Well, it's possible. And I've been told by others that it's such an advanced arduous therapy that it needs to be done primarily by more experienced therapists. However, you know, in my experience, prolonged exposure simply is an example of a fundamental misunderstanding of what war is. War is not composed of one traumatic event. Any veteran who did, you know, and most Marines I know did, you know, I talked to a veteran yesterday who did 6 deployments. He did 42 months in Iraq and Afghanistan. Do you think it was just one traumatic event for him that's bothering him? No, it was dozens and dozens and dozens of them. And so prolonged exposure to me is just wrong-headed because it's too atomized. It focuses on one event. And it might seem trivial to single out this one particular psychotherapy, which has a good scientific record, but this is the number when the VA was asked by 60 Minutes to profile their cutting-edge therapies, they said that our best therapy is this therapy. So I don't – and to me, that's just very frustrating because as a vet, you want people to understand your experiences and to have a better understanding of war and of what your – you know, the Iraq experience or Afghanistan experience might have been like. And, you know, and one of the things I have to say to people is it's not just one day, one event. It's every day. You know, living in the shadow of death for week after week impacts a person in a way that this particular therapy does not address. And I think it's frustrating because you want people to get what your experience was like.
Let's take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. David Morris is our guest. His book is called The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. We'll take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with David Morris. He's a former Marine infantry officer and war correspondent. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the New Yorker, Slate, the Daily Beast, and again, his new book called The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. And I do want to get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Also, email comments, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. But I do first want to talk about the success you had with something called cognitive processing therapy. Prolonged exposure therapy really did not work for you. In fact, it was really counterproductive. But this cognitive processing therapy, based on some of the work of Aaron Beck, who's also here in the Philadelphia area, seemed to be effective. And why do you think that was?
Well, cognitive processing therapy is the VA's other frontline PTSD therapy, and it asks you to examine your thoughts and feelings about your war experience or your trauma experience and look at the connection between thoughts you have and how those lead to feelings about yourself. And as an example, it's very common for rape survivors to say to themselves, well, I should have fought off my assailant better. In some ways, I could have prevented it or I didn't fight him off properly. And they end up saying, well, you know, good things happen to good people. Bad things happen to bad people. This happened to me. Therefore, I must be a bad person. And so the idea behind cognitive processing therapy is to examine different feelings and habits of thought that grow out of your traumatic experience and ask yourself whether or not those are very realistic.
Is it kind of like having a conversation with yourself?
In the book I describe, you know, prolonged exposure is almost like an emotional chemotherapy. And for me, CPT or cognitive processing therapy, which grew out of the larger work of Aaron Beck at the University of Pennsylvania, that to me felt more like an emotional Tai Chi or yoga. It was more, to use a physical metaphor, it was more about slowing your thoughts down and examining how they impacted your thinking on things and testing them against the reality of the world out there. And for me, it was I described it as sort of an emotional psychological first aid. It didn't resolve all the issues and all the problems I might have had after the Iraq War, but it was a good way to sort of examine, you know, where I was about stuff, and it was less risky. And somewhat more personalized than I felt that prolonged exposure was. And it treated a broad brush, a broad variety of experiences, and because any thought could be interrogated by the therapy. So that for me, and it was a group therapy. It wasn't this really intensive, deep, you know, Freudian psychoanalytic experience. But it was a good way to encounter and sort of, you know, rejudge some of your experiences from war.
Can we use the word cure when we're talking about PTSD?
I don't think that's the appropriate word because and I think when you actually examine PTSD and if you step back further away from it, it's basically a situation where a person has to change. The world, you know, they have been changed by the world and you cannot go back. And the idea of curing is if – and I think sort of the medical terminology and the fact that psychiatrists are primarily the people that we deal with PTSD, you know, which is kind of a very limiting thing because it's not – it doesn't address the moral and larger emotional concerns. So the idea of curing it in the manner that you might cure strep throat with some sort of antibiotic or some version of an antibiotic I think is not the best way to think of it. I think you have to address the fact that something very significant has happened to you and that the best way for you to live fully in the world and in the present is to consider ways that you as a person can change and grow and evolve in the shadow of your trauma.
I mean a more existential resolution.
Yeah, I mean and PTSD is many things but it impacts every aspect of a human's life, politically, psychologically, emotionally, economically. So you have to address those things and say to yourself, okay, well, I'm a different person now.
Let me get Rick from Warminster to join our conversation. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, good morning.
Good
morning. How are
you? Good. How
Pretty
are you?
Interesting discussion. Good.
Thank you.
I served 26 years and was in the Vietnam and then 20 years later in the Gulf War, infantry officer. One of the observations I've made is that when we went to Vietnam, 1969, we went as individuals. The troops that go over, these wonderful warriors now go as units. They've had a chance to get unit cohesion, a chance to form friendships, professional and personal, and they deploy for sometimes 6 months at a time. But while they are there, in some cases, they'll go out for a week or two, come back into a base camp, have Skype, talk to the family, see how things are going, go back out again. And in my opinion, there's a big contrast between those that served in Vietnam that went out and stayed out and those that somehow lose their game face, their function, if you will, and get distracted by being able to come back in and use the technology we have today.
It's interesting, Rick, and I'd be curious, David, what you say in response. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a big difference in terms of the way the military personnel policy worked from Vietnam to today, and they used to replace individual soldiers and Marines in theater in Vietnam. It was a one-to-one replacement system, and now the system is more the entire unit goes, an entire battalion will deploy from Camp Lejeune. And then come back, and there's even been a policy with recent in Afghanistan deployments where they keep the unit together for say 90 days after they get back, so they keep a sense of cohesion, and that's one very important thing. And that was one interesting thing as a war correspondent. Is I went over alone and I came over alone, and so my transition was a little bit rougher, and I didn't have as many buddies to rely on when I got back. And that can be a very frustrating thing because, you know, the United States is a very large country.
Sure.
And, you know, when you come back after deployment, when people get out, everyone goes back to Minnesota. They go back to Arkansas. They go back to Florida. And you lose touch with your buddies. And I think the military could do a better job, which the French and British do, of actually establishing some sort of regimental association system and supporting reunions and social connection. In a way, because, you know, like there was this one battalion that I embedded with in Ramadi, and they reunite every year. And they usually try to do it in Texas because it's central. But all those Marines have to pay, and their families, they don't have those connections, and they have to make them themselves, which is difficult.
Rick, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me quote something that you write in your book, David. Sometimes I think that half of combat PTSD in America would disappear overnight if we required citizens to take a more active role in both war making and welcoming warriors home. If there's a national security measure we need to pass, maybe it's one that forces citizens to directly involve in the war effort, either by reinstating the draft or by making VA employment a form of national service. I firmly believe that the lack of ritual and authentic public engagement in the war-making process is a major cause of PTSD. That's a profound thing to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tricky because, you know, one of the great contrasting examples when you look at PTSD is World War II. And I talked to a senior VA psychiatrist who'd been treating veterans for 30, 40 years. And one of the things he said was veterans returning from World War II, because there had been a draft system and there was a greater sense of the commitment to war, there was more opportunities to be understood. And I think that's one of the major challenges any trauma survivor has, is finding people that share, that have had similar experiences that you can share your story with. And that's really, really rare today. Now, veterans come back, and I think rape survivors are even more challenging position, because they are not encouraged in any way to share their story. No one says, please tell me your rape survivor story. That's something that rape survivors have been systematically excluded, denied throughout history. So, anytime
we sometimes don't believe them when they tell us their stories.
Absolutely, which is one of the worst ways to. I mean, imagine if I'd come back from Iraq and people told me, well, you weren't there. That's, being confronted with that kind of just gross misunderstanding is incredibly damaging. And that's one thing that I try to do in this book, is sort of share, to sort of celebrate the idea of survivorship and heroes that, people I've known that have survived rape and their heroic journey. And to encourage them. And one of the people that was most influential for me in writing this book was Alice Siebold from Paoli. Mm-hmm. She grew up in Paoli.
Yes, she did.
And her book, The Lovely Bones, and her memoir, Lucky, where she describes surviving a rape and eventually putting her rapist in jail. But celebrating the heroism and her story, I think, is because there are so few good. The literature on rape is very few and far between. Lucky was really one of the only books that people can look to for wisdom and insight into that experience. And so I want to celebrate the survivorship and the heroism of that sort of experience, which is in fact, 30, 40 times more common than military service. And rape is a very serious problem. 20% of all American women report being raped or being part of an attempted rape situation. So that's something that we have to address as a society.
I should add that she has been a guest on Radio Times in the past, just to underscore what you just said. Going back to your book, you write, the war gave me a kind of maturity, but it made me a child again. And the end of the book is sort of how you can miss war, you can be hurt by war, you can love war, you can have all these complicated feelings about being in a war zone.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, Winston Churchill said there's nothing so exhilarating as being shot at without result, without being wounded. And I think...
Meaning surviving,
obviously. Yeah, yeah. And anyone who's survives a car crash or, car accident or, near plane crash, near death experience, you come out of it with this rush of adrenaline and this kind of excitement and almost an epiphany. And if you think about the survivor experience of trying to extend that euphoria and love of life to the rest of your life and remember what your body was doing and the joy of being alive in the moment of near death and think about trying to live your life in the shadow of that type of feeling. And that was one thing that I noticed, is that, when I got back from the war, I valued people a lot more. I wasn't, as much of a, cynical, callous, teenager that I was growing up. And I had a better appreciation for what I had, both as an American and as a human being. And, my eyes, in some ways, my eyes sort of became really immature, and I enjoyed sunlight and the mountains and the sky and different visual experiences as kids kind of do, of just, with a bigger sense of wonder. And that, because that to me is the essence of being alive. And a lot of people come out of war with more of a spiritual sense and a greater sense of connection to the infinite and to God. And for me, it was more of a connection to the natural world and the idea of being alive and enjoying, being thankful for every breath you have.
Your book also looks at some of the history here. You quote from the Iliad. You quote from the Bible. I mean, this is something that humans have grappled with. They might not call it – they certainly didn't call it PTSD, but it's returning from war, perhaps the rituals that are needed to help people return from war, but also just how scarring war can be.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting to consider. If you look at the larger historical context, there are elements of PTSD that we would recognize. And for instance, in the Old Testament, there's a verse in the Book of Numbers that describes, that commands any returning warriors that have touched a dead body or killed someone to stay outside the camp for 30 days. So there is this sense of some sort of reintegration that needs to happen, some sort of addressing of the trauma. And both the ancient Israelites and the early Catholic Church felt that there was a ritual cleansing that needed to happen, that there needed to be a confession process, and that the killing that had been done needed to be morally confronted and morally processed with a priest, and that there needed to be some sort of penance done for the killing that you had been a part of, and which today, warriors today might find that sort of an offensive thing. But I think if you think about what it actually asks returning veterans to do, and I think that's one of the issues with this movie, American Snipers. He killed a lot of people. But the trauma of killing and the trauma of being a part of the killing process is not addressed. Americans today do not even think about that, of how that impacts the individual and how it should be in some ways ritually cleansed or processed. And you know, it sounds really ridiculous. Well, veterans should go to church and confess to a priest, but this has a long – there are centuries of history behind this idea and a lot of thinking that to address the moral concerns of returning veterans, which I think we just don't do today.
Well, I think a good therapist could help do that, because a good therapist deals with some of these moral existential dimensions.
Absolutely. But it's not that is an aspect of certain schools of therapy, but it's not a common part of the conversation. When people talk about PTSD today, we talk about symptoms, and most everyone wants to hear that there's a miracle drug waiting for them. And that is not the case, because there are drugs that can treat certain aspects of PTSD, but the idea of it is PTSD began, it's a product of the protest movement of the 1970s that grew up against the Vietnam War. The bedrock of PTSD is a moral argument, a political argument that survivors have stories.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. As you say, when you were signing up to be in the Marines, you wanted stories. I mean, you got a hell of a story, right?
I think so. Yeah, it took a while to find it. I mean, it's not one of the problems with the Iraq War is that didn't have a clear narrative line like World War II or even Vietnam, because there was at the end of Vietnam, people came back and there was this very serious political reckoning. There was a growth process that happened in the United States after Vietnam. We became a different country after Vietnam, and that's sort of one of my deep frustrations is that has not happened with Iraq. We are fighting the war again with this movie, American Sniper. The same battle lines are being drawn, and we're sniping at each other, literally, in this case, from across the barricades. And my argument is that we should have a greater sense of the limits of military power and the limits of our own political power, because the war in Iraq was a failure. We're fighting it again. We're fighting ISIS again, and ISIS would not exist if we hadn't invaded Iraq. We have a very serious responsibility with ISIS to address, because we helped cause the creation of ISIS.
We're almost out of time here, but you mentioned the movie American Sniper a number of times in about a minute or less. What do you think that movie is about? What is it saying?
We'll have to be careful, because I haven't seen the movie, and I will not see it for many years, probably because I find war movies to be very upsetting, and I would be really angry for about a week after I saw it. I was in Ramadi. I spent significant...
So no matter sort of how the story is told, it would still...
Well, I think, you know, there are some... I don't think that... I'm not happy with any of the war... I think the Hurt Locker was a terrible movie. I watched it backwards on a DVD because that was the only way I could watch it, but none of... I look at all the Iraq movies that have come out, with the one exception of In the Valley of Elah with Tommy Lee Jones. They're all, to me, very morally immature and morally childish. They don't, like, address the fundamental war, psychological concerns, like... The Thin Red Line, which came out in 1998, I think does that, but that's pre-9/11. I think Apocalypse Now in some ways addresses that, and Full Metal Jacket. But the movies of Vietnam actually looked at the morality and, you know, some of the politics of the war. But all of the other movies that have followed since are like, no, we're not going to do politics. American Sniper, we're not going to do politics. Hurt Locker, we're going to start, you know, we love the troops. We support the troops with this movie. And they're not addressing the larger moral concerns of the war, which to me is really immature.
Well, on that note, David Morris, thank you so much for joining us today
on
Radio
Times.
And also congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The book is called The Evil Hours, a biography of post-traumatic stress disorder. And the author of the book, David Morris. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. And you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.